Joining us now are the gurus of how-to, Alvin and Lawrence Ubell, the father and son, owners of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York, and regular visitors to our show. They come by once a month. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Are we getting very formal these days?
Just like
this. Well, you called me Lawrence. What's that about?
This is Larry. This is Al. Or Alvin and Lawrence. You know, either way you want to take it.
Well, what do you call each other? Well, I'm done. Don't answer.
That's opening up a door.
You mean our pet names?
Okay, well, moving right along.
Usually it's Larry to me and it's Dad.
Ah, okay, well, Dad and Larry are here. And we take your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. People are already calling in. We also have a quiz, mm-hmm. but before we get to, should we do the quiz first, or should we talk about some of the topics
well,
at hand?
Well, let the people warm up to the quiz. We'll give them what the quiz is all about. If you figure out what the word is, then you'll get a copy of Save Energy, Save Money by myself and Leonard
George Merlis.
George Merlis, who was my co-author. And so you want me to give the word?
Sure, your turn.
It's my word, yeah.
He's very excited about this one.
Yes.
It took him over 12 minutes to come up with it.
Well, is that long?
At my age, every moment is important.
Well, we appreciate the sacrifice.
All right. Name the light-stimulating material found in pigments and that absorb and resubmit light for the use of safety strips, exit signs, and visual cues.
They retransmit, they reflect it, right?
They retransmit the light that comes in, and then and these devices.
As we're driving down the road, we see this dark sign, and then the headlights pick it up, and the next thing you know,
can read the sign. No, that's a reflective kind
actually,
of
what
thing.
What he's talking about is when you're on the staircases in public buildings on the floor. Those strips that are along the floor that guide you when all the lights are out.
Okay.
So that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's actually mandated in high-rise buildings and in theaters.
Too much info.
All right, too much.
Okay, and so if you know the word, we invite you to call us at 212-433-9692, but we also invite you to call us if you have a question for the gurus, and that can cover a wide range of things. We have covered so many different things over the years.
Everything from flushing the toilet to skylights to the boilers, the air conditioning units.
We've even had questions about TVs, which is beyond
sewing
the
machines,
purview.
Sewing machines, refrigerators, stoves,
foundations,
creaky floors,
everything,
stairwells,
yes,
stairs,
mm-hmm. elevators,
okay,
and so on,
and broken sidewalks.
Yeah,
a lot of people have damp attics and damp basements and their
damp basement is a big number.
But yeah. I have to say something. There's an interesting thing. It's interesting you brought that up, damp attics, because attics are never supposed to be damp, ever, ever. And one of the things that we found recently, because of the new trends toward energy saving and sealing up buildings, we are finding, not only myself, but many home inspectors around the country, that plywood, the plywood roof sheathing, the underlayment that, you know, on your pitch roof or even flat roofs are rotting. And they're not rotting from the outside. They're rotting from the inside. Because what's happening is all this moisture is coming up through the building, collecting in the roof, on the underside of the roof. The roof, the material, the membrane is fine. And there's no way to get the moisture out. And they've sealed the buildings up so tight. So attic ventilation, roof cavity, or cock-off ventilation is so important to prevent this from happening. Because you'll see mold growing on the inside of an attic. And it's not from the outside of the building.
Now, is that because sheetrock is composed of certain
things? No. The underlayment is made of plywood.
And the moisture comes up from the building, from breathing, from cooking, from everything else. What I have seen literally hundreds of times in examining the buildings, you climb into the attic in the middle of the winter and you'll see icicles full coming down from from the nails.
But the roof is not
the
leaking.
Roof is not,
it's not leaking at all. It's just that water is collected. It's high concentration of moisture. Like, it's, for instance, in old churches. You've been in an old church where you get rained on in the middle of the church because all the moisture goes up to the top and condensates, hits its dew point, and rains back down.
Yeah.
That's what's happening in buildings, but they're not made of stone. Here they're made of wood, which is a natural product that is affected by mold and mildew and moisture.
It's
and all
a nutrient.
Things.
In time,
we'll have stalagmites and stalactites in our roofs, attics. No?
Right. You see them. You do see them.
Okay, let's take some calls. And our first caller is from Bay Ridge, Bill. Old Ridge, Old Ridge, New Jersey. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. What's up?
I had a new boiler put in just last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually paid a little bit more for this. I live in a townhouse. It's a two-story townhouse. But the boiler had this circulation thing that you paid a little bit more for that boiler because it circulates air, therefore you'd save money. And mm-hmm. it has three things on the fan, on, auto, or circulate.
Well, first of all, is this actually a boiler or a furnace?
It's a gas boiler.
Does it make hot water or does it make forced air?
No, forced air.
Forced air. So it's a furnace. It's actually a furnace. It's not a boiler. It doesn't boil water. Or it doesn't even warm water. So it's a furnace. Go on. Now that I know what you're talking about, go on.
All right. So it's forced air, and it comes through vents, certain vents. But it's cold air when it circulates. The air, you know, it'll heat up the house nice. And then I get this cold air blowing out of the vents.
Okay.
Right near where I'm sitting. And I put it on auto, or I put it on circulate. And it does the same thing.
There's a fan. There's a fan switch, right?
Right. The fan has three different things.
Yeah.
On, auto, or circulate.
Okay.
That only happens when you're getting cold air coming in. That only happens when you have the low limit temperature switch is not adjusted properly.
Well, actually, no. What I think is going on here is, I think that what's the name of the furnace that you got?
I think it's a train.
It's a train. I got to look into this because what's happening, it sounds to me, is that what my dad was saying was that the way that forced air systems generally work is that the heat, you turn up the heat, the gas or the oil come, you know, the flame comes up, warms up the heat exchanger, and then when the heat exchanger is warm, then the fan turns on and starts blowing the warm air around. You don't want the fan turning on immediately because you don't want to blow cold air around. It sounds to me that this recirculation option is something that's probably not functioning properly because that's one of the reasons that we don't have the fans on all the time is because we don't want cold air blowing on us. So what I think you should do is if you want to, you can actually email me at larry@accuratebuilding.com.
Can you hold on a sec?
Sure. We'll talk about it.
I'm going to put you on hold, and he'll give that information out to you. You can listen on the radio, okay?
What he's saying there is
he said he's a big fan. Are we talking about fans here?
We're talking about air handlers, but also fanatics. So we're talking about both. Anyway, but what's happening there is I think something's not working properly. I'd like to look a little further into this.
Yeah, this is something you can't do over the radio.
No.
Okay, well, here's another boiler question. This one is from Jeff from Park Slope. Mm-hmm. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, guys.
What's up?
Thanks for taking my call. This is really my father's house. We're trying to figure out what to do. He's got oil set up with a tank that's kind of semi-buried,
mm-hmm.
and it's about 30 or 40 years old. And mm-hmm. when you get past maybe 60% down in the tank, he starts getting a lot of sludge. I mean, who knows how much stuff is in there? The bottom line is I'm trying to figure out, can those things be cleaned? He was concerned if we clean it, we do damage, and then we start leaking. Do we need to bring in special environmental people to do this or permits?
Well, usually if there's any sludge inside of an oil tank, something like that, you should call your oil supplier. They generally have crews on their own that can flush out the tank before they refill it. That the best time to do is when the tank is on a low level and coming into the summer when you're not using oil except for maybe making hot water. But the point is that tank could be flushed out and take all of the sludge out. The other way to do that is they should have a filter on that oil system and a recirculator. So what happens is the oil pump pumps the water through the filter and then back the oil, rather, the oil through the filter and then back into the tank, and it keeps going until all the sludge is brought out into the filter and you throw away the filter.
But
so,
but
there's a many different ways of cleaning that sludge out.
But I want to say there are companies that do come in and suck out the oil. As far as your father's concerned about them damaging the tank, if the tank is already damaged, this is not going to do it. If the tank has a damage problem, maybe you might want to have it tested anyway, because the way they test oil tanks these days is with sonar, not with pressure, because they found that the pressure thing didn't work so well. Because they kept blowing out the tanks. So now they use sonar, and if there is a leak in the tank, they can tell. But by all means, if there's that much sludge at the bottom of your oil tank, you need to call up a reclaimer or company that takes the bad oil away.
Sludge R Us,
yeah. There are several companies. Where are you located?
The house is in Yonkers, in Westchester.
In Yonkers, yeah. There's a company up there, I think, in Carmel that does oil tank work. So you can look around. There's plenty of them
okay,
around.
Jeff, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much, thanks. Bye.
No problem.
Cheryl from Rego Park. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Cheryl.
Oh, thank you very much for putting me on.
What's up?
I
hope we're not
no
putting you on,
house
Cheryl.
Right now, and I'm seriously considering going with solar heating and hot water and biofuel for a new boiler rather than natural gas. I have an old boiler that had been from 1923, first coal, then oil, then natural gas, and I'm kind of fed up with them for a few reasons. So I'm wondering if biofuel would work.
Well, the thing is that before you start going toward in the biofuel direction, find out where your source is going to be. Because you need to have a constant source of biofuel, whether that is, oil from restaurants, which is generally the biggest source, but that there are companies that are going to deliver it. And is that delivery cost, though it is much more environmentally friendly, is it, and your neighbors are going to love the fact that your exhaust is going to smell like French fries, but also, is it going to be economically feasible? As far as solar for domestic hot water, everyone that I've spoken to in the home inspection biz who has them, and these are colleagues of mine and people who own them, they've all been very happy with them. And even during the winter time when, it's cold out or it's got clouds out, there's just such enough solar energy that comes even through the clouds that they are pretty happy with that system. And you can even use a system like that for heating the house also by circulating. So you have a combination of both a boiler, which you can use with biofuel, and also the solar panels, which can create heat.
Yeah, but there's also another thing that can be done. If you have if you want a hot water, say it, and save energy on the hot water, but you want a high recovery ratio, you could actually have a gas-fired unit with an electric solar energy electrical preheating system that tempers the water to a higher temperature, so you don't have to use a lot of fuel to raise your temperature. But the most important thing about hot water is the recovery ratio, so that you have enough hot water if you take a long shower or
actually the way these things work is that the water that's actually going through the panels on the roof are not the water that you actually use for heating. There's a heat exchanger in a tank that sits inside the building, so those tanks usually are anywhere between 80 and 100 gallons. So you usually have about 80 or 100 gallons of standing hot water.
Standing hot water, but it's still sometimes if you're taking a shower or a bath at night, when those tanks cool down, you may not have enough recovery ratio. That's the biggest complaint that we get.
It's really interesting that we've gotten all these calls on boilers, isn't it?
Well, what part of the year are we in?
This is WNYC, WNYC.org, and we're not boiling in this room. My guests are the gurus of how to, Alan Larry U. Bell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And this is, did I say it was WMYC, WMYC.org? Well, I'll say it again. We have a quiz in effect, and people have been calling in with answers. The quiz is name the light-stimulating material found in pigments that absorb and retransmit light that are used in safety strips, exit signs, and visual clues. And let's see if anybody has the right answer. We begin with Tom from Park Slope. Hi, Tom. What do you think it is?
Hi.
Hi.
My guess is phosphors.
No, it's there is some of these special strips that do use some phosphorus in it, but that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for
Okay,
the actual term.
No.
I'm not saying the term.
Okay, how about Miles from Edison, New Jersey? Hi, Miles. What do you think it is?
Is he Miles
Optical
from
fibers.
Edison? What was that?
Optical fibers.
No.
Okay, how about Glenn from New York City?
A phosphorescent?
No, that's not it either.
But
or either.
Neither and neither. Okay, Chris from New Jersey. Chris?
Hi. Yep, I'm here.
Yeah, what do you think it is?
It's electroluminescence.
No, but thank you for playing.
And Ciro from... You're ready to have your own quiz show now.
Go ahead.
Ciro from Garfield, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Fluorescence.
No.
Okay.
Everyone's so close. I can taste it.
Joe from Queens. Hi, Joe, what do you think it is?
I think it's photoluminescence.
All right. How did you know?
I was Boy Scout, and years ago we went camping, and back in those days you were allowed to chop down trees and at night for firewood. And at night, all of the chips from the wood started to glow from phosphorus, and just started me as a lifelong quest because I became fascinated with that.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a real great new, not very new material, but it is a much better material than when they used to use radium in your wristwatches, and people were getting contaminated. And so this started that kind of effort. And this is like the fourth or fifth or sixth stage of trying to get something that's not radioactive but has great absorption of light from the photons of light, and then distributes them when the lights are out.
So are they using these in wristwatches as well?
Yes, they're using the same material in a lot of different things now, but most importantly, it is for guiding people out of buildings where the lights lighting system fails in the building, such as had in many tall buildings that we have when there's a fire or something like that, or at night, or an explosion. This device will save thousands of lives in years to come.
And, Joe, you do get a prize.
Hey, that's great.
So I'm going to put you on hold, give all the information, address, et cetera, to my producer. But what does he receive, Al?
He gets recipes for home repair. The Alubel Energy Saving Guide for Homeowners.
Okay. And thank you so much for playing the game.
Thank you.
Now, we've also been getting people writing in, and maybe I should read a few of these.
Yes.
Paul in Brooklyn writes, I live on the first floor of a 15-unit co-op with steam heat. My apartment is closest to the boiler. The radiator is first in line. It's constantly spitting some water to the point that I keep a tray to catch the runoff. The part-time super claimed the radiator needed emptying and did so, as well as changing the air valve. Subsequently, the problem got worse. I understand the balance of a steam system is a bit tricky. Any thoughts on how this can be solved?
Well, it depends upon how that system works. There are two kinds of systems. If it's a very large building, it's probably a two-pipe system. But smaller structures are one-pipe system that need an air valve. But the air valve has to be designed or has to be calibrated or picked out for the particular apartment and the size of the radiator and how the radiator is feeding. The other thing is that the valve that shuts off the radiator, which is on the opposite side of the air valve, has to be fully open. There is no such thing as halfway open. And because if it's not fully open, it does not permit the condensate to roll back to the boiler.
So he just has to open up the air valve?
No, not the air valve, but the shutoff valve on the opposite side of the air valve. That has to be wide open so that the condensate can flow back in the condensate drain. If it is a two-pipe system, then there's the condensate drain on one side, and that has to be there's a steam trap that has to be cleaned and made that the aperture is wide open.
But chances are, if it is spitting, it's probably the air vent that's broken or defective, and it just needs to be replaced. The proximity of his radiator to the boiler is little bearing on what's going on here.
Or if it's pitched right.
Well, still, if it's pitched wrong, it shouldn't be spitting.
No.
And we're talking about spitting here. He hasn't said anything about banging and knocking, has he?
No, I know.
Well, you're talking about pitching and spitting. Baseball here?
don't throw more into the mix than anyone said.
Another person, Edward in New Jersey, along these lines writes, the air vent in my steam radiator is stuck open. I tried cleaning it with vinegar, but it's still stuck, and it hisses and spits the whole time.
More spitting
the steam
and
is
hissing.
On. Yeah.
Sounds like my cats.
I purchased a new valve with a 1/8-inch connector, and it doesn't seem to fit. Do older radiators use an odd size connection, or might there be some sort of buildup fouling the threads?
Well, sometimes if there's a demand in a particular radiator for more steam, sometimes it's very hard to find an air valve that has a wide open aperture. So what you have to do is put another connection, like a T-fitting, on the output of that where the valve goes, and put two valves on that unit so that you have a wide open aperture so that the radiator heats up and the heat hits the valve, and by a bimetal device, it shuts the valve off when the radiator has it at its proper temperature.
There's one thing I do want to say to the gentleman who called up earlier about his heating, his furnace with the recirculating system. When he does write me, tell me what model number of heating equipment you have, and that might make my life a little bit easier.
Okay. Let's go to John from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi, John.
Yes, hi.
What's up?
I have an 80-year-old house in New Jersey. The living room ceiling painting, the paint in the ceiling is cracking and curling.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone and scraped away all the loose paint. And my question is, should I sand down the adjacent paint so it tapers to nothing to where the exposed plaster is, or should I try to leave a defined edge there before I go back and spackle where the paint has been taken away?
Well, a sandpapering a surface prior to the application of a coating or paint, as you would call it, is really the optimal way of preparing a surface. The paint will adhere better because it has scratches in order for it to lock into that scratches that the sandpaper makes. But to make a definitive line, we'll always put your eye to the fact that there is a differential. The thing is cleaning the surface of any surface thoroughly and maybe a little bit of sandpaper will give you the best surface for application. Best of all, before you commence, is read the instructions on the container meticulously, which a lot of people do not do. How to apply that particular manufacturer's material to the surface of which you intended.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
And we thank you all so far who have called. Mm-hmm. We invite you to continue calling here, our number 212-433-9692. You can leave comments on our show page for the Gurus of How To, Al and Larry Ubell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. We will continue our conversation. Take a lot more calls after we take a little break. Stay with us. Hope we haven't been gone too long, just a few minutes, right? We're back with the Gurus of How To.
You know the tune that you have here, the How Are You Going to Fix the Broken Heart of Mine? You know, we talk about that.
Are you cardiologists?
No, you get the glue of love. That's how you fix it.
Okay. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Valentine's Day is coming up, I guess. That was that should have been said on the air, right? Okay. Okay. Libby from Highland Park, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Are you feeling loved,
kitchen.
Libby?
Pardon?
Are you feeling loved?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Definitely. We have a kitchen about 8 years old. We put it in when we moved in.
Mm-hmm.
The kitchen cabinets are maple and stain finished. They're called the color was called Arctic Denim.
Okay.
It's very pretty, very unusual. But
wait, Arctic Denim? What does that mean? That means blue jeans that you wear up in Alaska?
What?
Arctic Denim. We want to know what is that?
No, that's just the color. That was the chip in the samples of the kitchen cabinets. One was called Arctic Denim, and that's what we had done in our kitchen.
Hang on a second. I think they just ran out of...
Are you guys all right?
No. I think they just ran out of things to call colors, and they just got Arctic Denim.
Cerulean blue.
But that's actually...
Cerulean blue is based on a real color. Real mineral.
Yeah, Arctic Denim.
But this one is paling in comparison.
Are you listening?
Yes, we're listening.
Okay.
We're not going anywhere. Don't worry.
Yeah.
The cabinets
are not clean. They have, grease spots from our hands on the handles.
Yes.
How do we clean them? We're afraid to take. We'll take the finish off if we use anything. We don't know what to do.
Well, I would try. I would.
Obviously, you tried soap and water, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that didn't work, just kitchen soap?
We haven't even done that. A little bit in some spots I've used it, but it doesn't seem to work. The grease seems to have absorbed into the cabinet.
Well, the thing is, what you can do, there are two things. If this is natural wood and there is no real coating on top of it other than the wood itself, first of all, I would try to fix those blemishes with a little alcohol only. Just raw alcohol on a piece of sponge and wipe it off. And if that doesn't do anything...
Well, she says it's a finish. Well, so won't the alcohol take the finish off?
Well, she mentioned that it was natural wood.
It's maple wood, but it's stained finish.
It's a stained finish. That means there is no coating on it.
Okay.
That's something that has absorbed into the wood. And the stain usually was put in with the pigment mixed with probably boiled linseed oil or boiled lemon oil of something like that.
Okay.
What I would do is there is a product that is sold readily on the many different brands, and it's called lemon oil finish. And I would buy a bottle of that and try a corner of it. And if it works, then do the whole furniture with this lemon oil. I've used that lemon oil on handrails and oak flooring and stuff like that.
Let me ask you a question. Is the interior of the cabinets the same color as the exterior of the cabinets?
I'm just going to look. No.
Okay.
That's my husband.
Yeah, really, or the mailman. I don't know. Anyway.
That's my husband.
Okay, good.
What are you drinking?
We're having a good time. So the inside of the cabinets are not the same color, right?
Well, the insides of the doors are.
Okay, that's what I mean. So what I would do is try what my dad is suggesting on the inside of the door.
Yeah.
So see what happens. I mean, I was thinking the same thing.
Good idea.
Soap and water first. I would try the alcohol like he recommended. It really shouldn't take off the finish. And the third is the lemon oil cleaner. I would try those, and that should really be effective in taking it off. And it shouldn't really mar or take off the finish at all. I mean, these finishes are designed to be in a kitchen where they know, unless it wasn't designed to be in a kitchen, and that's a whole other litigation issue as far as product liability.
It's supposed to be in the kitchen.
Okay. Then they designed it that it is going to be exposed to grease and oil and foods and stuff like that. So it really, they need to be, they obviously are a little bit more hardy than we're giving them credit for. So I'm not really that concerned. So try those couple of things. And also, you might want to even call up the cabinet manufacturer and see what they suggest, because that always usually works pretty well. Manufacturer specifications are always a good place to start.
Thank you so much for calling us, Libby.
I know we're not drinking.
Steven.
Really, I never.
Steven North Brunswick writes, my house was built in 1987. I still have the original wood vertical siding. During Hurricane Irene's wind and rainstorms, I had water coming down the inside of one of my walls, an outside wall. After having two contractors diagnose my problem, it was determined that there are small gaps in between the vertical siding slats where during extreme wind and rainstorms, water can make its way into and down the wall. Aside from replacing all the siding, which is, of course, what the contractors wanted to do, is there any other way that this can be sealed?
Well, first of all, excuse me. The first thing is anything that is loose on that siding should be resecured. And the best thing to make everything as tight as you possibly can. And my suggestion, depending upon how the wood is put together and how the siding is put together, is to use these long, thin stainless. You can buy stainless steel screws that go right through the sheathing into the underlayment that's holding the whole thing together and tighten it all up. And that alone should be able to prevent water and leakage and seepage into the wood. And it really works very well that way.
But I have to say that I'm also concerned about what they said during extreme wind conditions, because I've heard more than this tale a few times that that water's coming in during the hurricane that people haven't had before. And one of the things I am concerned about is that what is this material? Is it actually real siding or is it simulated siding?
And that's a good point.
Because if it's the original siding but it's not real, they make this material that's basically plywood or actually almost a composite board, OSB, orientational strand board, which is basically chips of wood pressed together with a surface on the outside. If water gets in there, it can do some major damage. Us in the home inspection business actually call that vertical mulch because once it gets wet, it just falls apart. So I think a little bit of an exploratory opening may need to be done. And though the contractors want to do the big job may be what's necessary. So you need to do a little bit more research than just nailing away or caulking or something like that.
Larry from Bayside, you're on the air. You don't have to whistle, Larry.
Hi, thank you very much.
We were here. We know you're there.
I was not sure because the volume.
Do you also whistle
changing.
Bartenders and things like that?
I usually just snap my fingers and they all come running.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that works real well, especially
right,
with the
guys.
Female ones.
I've been trying to talk my co-op out of using number 6 bunker oil for years because of the pollution.
And
finally, the city has mandated that it has to be phased out.
Right.
And over the next 3 or 4 years. So most of the co-ops are converting over to something called dual fuel operation, where they can use either oil or natural gas.
Correct.
But I'm wondering if it makes more sense just to convert to natural gas. It would be a little less expensive. You wouldn't have to maintain the oil tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I understand, the thermal efficiency of using a gas system is much higher, and the maintenance on it is much lower. And this is a building. These are 5 buildings all supplied by one massive boiler with a hot water system into 4 convection units, and then they chill the water in the summertime.
Right.
I'm trying to get them to separate the domestic water from the heating water because you could turn off the main boiler for 5 months of the year.
Right.
And I can't get them to listen to me at all. Is there an advantage to going to natural gas, or should they do dual fuel? Or should they're probably going to go the cheap way and just convert to number 2 nozzles.
Right. Let me answer your question.
Larry for Larry.
Yeah, so here's my feeling. The first thing is I agree with you about separating domestic hot water and the heating equipment, because I'd rather have 2 systems, because if one goes down, you still have the other. Domestic hot water is more efficient at creating domestic hot water than running a boiler that makes water for everything but is not as efficient when it has to make domestic hot water.
Right.
The second thing I want to say is that going with the dual fuel, the dual fuel has its advantages is because when the temperature drops below a certain point, I believe it's 20 degrees, the gas company cuts off your gas and you got to go to oil. So you get a better price on your gas for the times when you are using gas.
Why would the gas company cut off gas?
Because everyone is using a lot of gas, and it takes the burden off the system if all these big buildings now have to use their oil.
Not if the building is dedicated to gas alone.
Yeah, no. If you're using dual fuel, you'll get a better price on the gas, because when it comes to high demand periods, you now have to change to oil for that short period of time during high demand, and they give you a better price on gas since you're not using gas all the time.
But your father's right. If it's a dedicated gas system,
no,
then
you
have
to. Then you can't do that. That's correct. I'm talking about. I did say dual fuel at the beginning of my point. So actually, it may have some advantages. The maintaining of the oil tank, that if the oil tank is questionable at this point, that's a determining factor also. But as far as converting 2 gas and number 2 oil, it seems to me, actually, I did some calculations, and actually, per therm, it's actually at this point way cheaper to run gas. I think it came up with I wrote it down somewhere. I don't remember what it is, but I think gas, the last time I checked, came out to be about $2 and came out to be $2.65 per therm, where oil came out to be $3.40 per therm. So yes, gas at this point in time is way more efficient.
So what are we saying to him? He should just
I actually recommend the dual fuel, because you get a better price on gas for the, and if it was this year, you would never be running oil because we never drop below 20 degrees. So you would have been running gas all summer and gotten a great price on your gas and just maintaining the oil. oil. But when we have a brutal winter, you'll still get a good price on your gas. But for those few nights that you actually have to run the oil, I still think that you'd probably be – the numbers have to be crunched. But I think
But what about the cost of the boiler itself?
Well, the boiler –
aren't the dual boilers more expensive?
It's just the gun. It's just the boiler.
The stoker or the gun.
The burner. The burner is either a dual fuel or a single fuel burner. So I would actually look into those, you know, number crunching issues before one would make a decision.
Okay,
even
Larry.
Thinking of the forecast that natural gas is going to continue to go down in price and heating oil will continue to go up.
Yeah, I am looking.
Nothing keeps on going down or up,
but
as
I mean,
we saw with the housing bubble.
Well, as in proportion to each other, I mean, especially since, you know, it does look like, you know, some of the ways of getting gas out of the ground seems to be cheaper and cheaper.
Unless they start regulating fracking, natural gas will continue to go down.
That's another issue also. But you know what? Luckily, this state, they're a little bit more active about regulating fracking, but there are other states in the union where they don't seem to be as concerned about those things.
Thank you for your call. Patricia from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have two questions. The first one concerns my sister, who has a mirror in her kitchen, and over the years, the surface of the mirror has deteriorated, and she's concerned about the possible risk of mercury poisoning.
As far as the mirroring on the backside, in other words, the silver is deteriorating. Is that what you're saying?
I guess so.
Yeah. In other words, it's turning black or turning different colors or it's peeling off.
Is there any mercury in that?
There is a lot of different things they use. Some of them they use actual silver, and some of them they use aluminum. Sometimes they did use mercury. There were so many different processes that I really can't tell you definitively about your sister's mirror. But I would not be – what I would do best of all is if you can get to the backside and encapsulate the backside with, say, some sort of vinyl or even paint it with a regular latex or alkyd paint would be enough to encapsulate the surface and not let it spread throughout the apartment.
But wouldn't it be just better for her to take it to some mirror place and have the whole back redone?
Only unless the mirror is a quality mirror and has etchings in the mirror itself to make it design well. If it has beveled edges and stuff like that, or
is this a wonderful mirror, Patricia?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I don't really think it's antique mirror or anything of, you know.
If it's not a decorative mirror, it is best that you throw out the mirror and buy a brand new one.
And we thank you for your call. We go now to Chris from Brooklyn. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Chris. What's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Yes.
So my question is about installing a railing on my mother's porch. She's she's getting up in the area. She lives in a kind of a pre-made house from the 1990s down in North Carolina. And she's got these lightweight aluminum railings on her front porch steps. At the top, they're like screwed into the wood banister, the wood post of the porch. But at the bottom, they're bolted into the brick. And both sets of bolts and screws have been rusted out and worn out. And I'm not sure I'd like to replace them, but I'm not sure how to secure them to the brick.
Well, as far as that's concerned, I physically would have to take a look at the mechanical connections that you have to the balusters, the railings, the newel posts, and everything else that goes along with it to see which would be the most cost-effective way to either salvage what you got there and strengthen what you got there, or maybe it has to be replaced. This requires an examination by a technician that is familiar with the installation and design of handrails and balusters and things of that sort.
This brings us to, believe it or not, the end of this installment
already?
Of the Gurus of How To.
Already?
Yeah, we've run out of time.
I thought we were going to be here for a couple hours.
But, first of all, I'm happy to announce that you'll be back on March 16th. So when we do this all again. But before then, if people have emergencies, Larry, you invite them to get in touch with you?
Yes, and actually last month I actually did a pretty good job of getting most of my emails. It was very good. And email me directly. Sometimes I don't get some of the web
But you want them to include a phone number.
A phone number, very important phone number, at larry@accuratebuilding.com. You can check out our website at www.accuratebuilding.com also.
And you'll be back next month too?
Well, we'll go forth and fix, save energy, money, and
do it safely.
On tomorrow's show, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talks about his career in the NBA, his advocacy work, and his new book for children. And then Jonah Hill on his Oscar-nominated role as Brad Pitt's nerdy cohort in Moneyball. Also, A History of the World in 100 Objects looks at a Chinese Zhu ritual vessel, plus our latest backstory segments. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Ellen Frankman. John Delore was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.